Good morning. Good morning. My name is Kelsey Dick, and I'm a junior geology major. It is my honor to introduce to you today's convocation speaker, Dr. Alan Cutler. Dr. Cutler graduated from Carleton College in the class of 1975 and holds an MS from the University of Rochester and a PhD in geology from the University of Arizona. He is now a writer affiliated with the Smithsonian Institution. Dr. Cutler was also a contributing editor to The Forces of Change, A New View of Nature, a joint publication of the Smithsonian and the National Geographic Society. Dr. Cutler's writing has also appeared in The Washington Post, The Sciences, among other publications. The Seashell on the Mountaintop is the title of convocation today, and also the title of Dr. Cutler's recent literary nonfiction book, detailing the discoveries of Nicholas Steno, the Danish anatomist and founder of modern study of geology and paleontology. He'll be signing copies of this book here at the front of the chapel immediately following the convocation. Please join me in welcoming back to Carleton College, Dr. Alan Cutler.
Thank you, Kelsey. And thank you all for coming. I can't tell you how much of a thrill it is to be back here to give this convocation speech, not just because coming here brings back a lot of really wonderful memories of four great years that I spent here, but in a sense, this book got its start here when I was a freshman, fall term, and I took Geo 10. And I learned about the subject of this book, Nicholas Steno. And I can't say that at that time I had any kind of inkling that I would ever pursue anything about him. In fact, I barely even remember what was said about him in class. But I must have on the final because I passed the course. But 30 years later, I came back and wrote a book about him, and I guess the message of that is you never know. Maybe somewhere in your class notes there's a little nugget someplace that 30 years from now will be the germ of some book you'll write or some intellectual adventure that you'll have. Maybe it won't take 30 years. Maybe it will. I don't know. At any rate, what brought me back to Nicholas Steno after all those years of not remembering who he was the millennium and all the hoopla at that time in the late 90s. And I would read these various articles on the top 10 scientific discoveries of the millennium and the great achievements of the greatest scientists of the millennium. And there was the usual suspects, Isaac Newton and Darwin and Galileo and Copernicus and all the very famous discoveries of gravitation and evolution and the double helix. But there was nothing in these articles in Time magazine and elsewhere, nothing about the discovery of geologic time. Nothing. And I was really surprised because this is a discovery that underlies a lot of the other ones. The Big Bang doesn't make sense without vast amounts of time. Evolution, of course, doesn't make sense without vast amounts of time. Why wasn't anybody mentioning it? It seemed like a really terrible omission. And as a geologist, I knew that geology's great contribution, really, to human thought is the idea that our planet has got a past to it, a very long past, an unimaginably long past. But it's a past that has a tangible record right in the rocks around us, in the crust of the earth. And this was an important message that no one was writing about. So I decided I'd write about it. And in the course of researching this, I discovered, of course, that putting together a history of the world, one that spans 4.5 billion years, such a long history, that wasn't a single discovery by a single person. It was a long, cumulative process to which a lot of different scientists contributed. So there wasn't one single hero, one discoverer of geologic time. But there was a person, Nicholas Steno, who was the one who really told science where to look and how to look at the rock record, the history of our planet. So that's how I ended up writing about Steno. And what got Steno involved in this question, he had been trained as an anatomist, and later in his life he became a priest, and so there was just a few short years that he was a geologist, the world's only geologist at that time. What got him intrigued was a question that, in fact, had intrigued people for centuries. And it was the question that makes the title of my book, Seashell on the Mountaintop. Since ancient times, people had trekked up in the mountains, they'd found seashells up there. They'd be out in the desert, and they'd find seashells. What are these things doing here? Leonardo da Vinci wrote about it. A number of the medieval scholastic philosophers wrote about this question. It's even mentioned by the very earliest philosophers, the pre-Socratic Greeks in the 6th century BC. They write about this, and they came to the conclusion that the world has different cycles, and that the element earth and the element water can transform back and forth into one another. So this was something that people had thought about a long time, and on a scientific or quasi-scientific basis. And when Nicholas Steno was alive, this was something that was hotly debated. And this slide here is a book that was published during Steno's lifetime by an Italian artist named Agostino Silla. And the title of the book is Vain Speculation Undeceived by Reason. And you can see that I'm not really sure which one's vain speculation, which one's reason, but they're talking about the seashells and the sand dollars that are over there on the rocks. Now, in addition to this scholarly thinking about the seashells on the mountaintop, there also have been a very long tradition in many cultures of a flood. The Sumerians had a flood myth. The Greeks had a flood myth, and of course there was the story in the Bible of Noah and the Great Flood, which is illustrated here, which had always been a possible explanation for many people for the seashells up in the mountaintop. It was just that these shells were the high watermark of a great flood. But this had always been a kind of an unsatisfactory explanation for many people. The shells of those people that knew something about shells recognized that a lot of the shells were marine species, and the waters of the flood had come down in the rain of 40 days and 40 nights, and that would have been fresh water. So what were the saltwater clams doing there? But even more problematic was the idea, was a problem that came about from the idea that they found the clams and shells inside of the rocks of mountains. Well, if you see in the picture here, mountains already existed at the time of the flood. It was a common assumption that the Earth's surface and the mountains had been created during the first week, and the flood came many, many years later. So that would have explained if the shells were lying around on the tops of the mountains, but not if they were inside of the rocks. How did the shells get inside of the rocks? So by the time of the 17th century, the leading explanation for seashells in rocks, in mountaintops, had nothing to do with the flood. The belief was that the shells that were inside of the rocks were not really shells. They were just images of shells. They looked like shells. They were shell-like rocks They were objects that had grown into the shape of shells within the rocks. They were sports of nature. I'm going to read just a paragraph from my book where I talk about this. Bizarre as it may seem today, in the context of the time, this idea made perfect sense. Some of the more mystical currents of Renaissance thought were still popular, even among those who prided themselves for their rationality. Neoplatonists and Hermetic philosophers had taught that all things on and within the earth were shaped by plastic forces and invisible emanations from the stars. No one knew how these mysterious forces and emanations actually produced stones in the shapes of seashells, but the world was a mysterious place. No one knew how a magnet's force caused it to attract an iron bar or orient itself toward the north. No one knew how the sun's emanations made flowers grow. These things happened in front of the eyes, yet they were still mysterious. Who could say what was or was not possible in the depths of the earth? Now, I want to emphasize that, you know, a lot of these ideas that were current in the past can sometimes seem odd or ridiculous today, but they really had, in their minds, a good, solid, intellectual, and scientific basis for believing these things. You know, we might think it's crazy that a rock could take, you know, get a shape and perfect shape in of a clam, down to every detail. And if, you know, we could go back in time and say, you know, how could that really happen? Come on. But if we ask them, well, how could a rock get the shape of a clam? They would ask, well, how does a clam get the shape of a clam? They didn't know anything about DNA. There was no genetics at that time. They just knew that things in nature got certain shapes. And the idea was that objects on Earth were images of another realm of perfect forms. So a clam got its shape not because any kind of any instruction code within the clam, but the information, as it were, would be beamed down from this other realm and shape the clam in its shape. So if that's how a clam got its shape, a clam in the mud deep in the ocean, well, why couldn't a rock intercept that same information? I mean, it's even closer to this other realm. I mean, it would work as well for one as the other. That was certainly a simpler explanation than having mountains jump out of the ocean or ocean drain away and become a desert. A huge transformation like that didn't make any sense. They had no explanation for that, but they did have an explanation for the shapes of these rocks. Also, looking at it from a biological standpoint, it was assumed, Aristotle had written, that the way that mollusks and other invertebrates reproduced was by spontaneous generation. That's, you know, you have a pile of garbage and you get the worms that just generating within the garbage. You've got the appropriate condition, these invertebrates would be produced. They would arise. Well, if you've got some limey rock up on top of a mountain and it rains and it gets wet, well, that's good conditions for a clam. I mean, it's the same as a moist, limey mud in the ocean. Or you get rain in a desert on a salty soil. Salty mud, great stuff. I mean, you know, it's not the clam's fault that they would grow and then they would be in the wrong place. So it just made a lot of sense, and they had no mechanism for altering the earth. Another issue that made it difficult to imagine these huge changes in the earth was that there really wasn't thought to be enough time in history for these huge changes. Oh, I forgot a couple of things. In addition to the issue of the shells reproducing by spontaneous generation, there were a lot of other objects besides shells that people found in rocks. These actually are fossils. The cone-shaped things are skeleton of a squid-like organism called belemnites, and the two things on the right are the pieces of the stalks of sea lilies, fossils. But none of these creatures were known at that time because the belemnites are extinct and the crinoids live in deeper water, so people had never seen them. So to a 17th century eye, these looked like just geometric shapes. There's a cone, there's cylinders, there's stars. So you've got to find stars in the rocks. Are you saying that the rock used to be in the sky? In addition to the geometric shapes, people could find on rocks the alphabet and other geometric shapes. So the mollusks and the clams were just one of many odd things that people found within the rocks. So that it was easier to have an explanation like the explanation of the platonic forms and the things generating in the earth, have one explanation that explained all of it than to try to turn the world upside down just to explain the clams. Now, getting back on track, there wasn't enough time. This is Archbishop James Usher, who's the most famous of the biblical chronologists. There actually, during the 17th century and before and after, there were a number of people that studied the Bible, studied the different generations, and calculated what they thought was the duration of the world's history. And this is a page from Usher's main contribution, published in 1655. And you can see here that I can't really point, but in the second paragraph, October 23 is the date that he calculated that the creation occurred, and that was in the year 4004 BC. He was actually a very gifted scholar, and he's the most famous because he was actually the best and most rigorous of all these chronologists. But anyway, 6,000 years didn't really allow much time for mountains to rise out of the ocean. And also, if you were to suggest the other possibility, that maybe these things happened rapidly, well, then why weren't these things written about in the history books? I mean, if you have mountains jumping up and down, someone's going to notice, someone's going to write about it. And if they happened slowly, there just wasn't enough time because no one had ever seen it much change in the elevation of the mountains around them. So the idea of geologic change in the earth wasn't something that seemed plausible to people, and for the shells that they found, they had a perfectly good explanation. And that's where Steno comes in. He was born in Denmark in 1638. His name was Niels Stensen. And as was customary when he enrolled in school, he took on a Latin name, and he was learning Latin, and all his papers were signed in Latin. And that was Nicholas Stenonis, but in English publications, he's called Nicholas Steno, and that's how I'm going to refer to him. He was born in 1638. He was born into a very strict Lutheran family. Received an education at the University of Copenhagen, and then, as was customary during that time, he spent his postgraduate years traveling around Europe as an itinerant scholar, working as an apprentice with other scholars. His particular field of expertise was medicine, and particularly anatomy. He turned out to be an extremely gifted dissector, there are many reports of his skill in dissecting cadavers and finding very delicate and minute structures that the other anatomists had missed. So he studied, of course, anatomy, but he had a very wide-ranging interest. And in fact, to be a physician during that time required study of not just the things we might associate with medicine, anatomy, but botany and astrology. You need to, you know, keep that and take that into account if you're treating a patient. And also the science of stones. Now here's some stones, Glossopetra, that were known as tongue stones. And these were of interest to people because they were thought to have medicinal value, as many other unique and odd stones were thought to. And also, the study of stones was important for a medical education because it was assumed that the growth of stones and fossils within the earth was a process that was comparable to the growth of stones within the human body. So you would find a book about stones and it would have agates and rubies and gemstones and whatever, and then gallstones, kidney stones, and all these other things, all on the same page because they were all stones. They all had the same stony nature, so they were all in the same intellectual bin. So these tongue stones were something that Steno was very familiar with. And he read about some of the debates that had been going on about shells up in the mountains. We actually have a that was found in the 1950s, one of his student journals, when he was a student in Copenhagen. And he writes about all these different topics. He jots down notes from his readings. And it's kind of interesting because you can sort of sense the course of his thinking and some of these things, because he'll be writing, copying something from some book, and then the next sentence will be, "Sure is cold in here. Maybe I better get some more wood from the fire." And then the next thing he says, "I wonder why it is that sparks go up with the smoke, and you know, wonder how crystals grow. I see these snowflakes in the window," and then his mind jumps from one thing to another. And there's even a quote there saying, "Oh, I pray thee, O God, take this plague away from my mind and free me of all my soul of all distractions, so I can concentrate on one thing and study the tables of medicine alone." And I, you know, I really related to that when I was working on this book. But at any rate, he got a medical education, and as he was traveling around, he developed some fame as a dissector. He was made some very fundamental discoveries that I won't go into now because it just isn't the time, in the nature of muscles and the nature of the heart. And he had a very very important lecture and dissection of the human brain that really clarified a lot of the details of its anatomy. And this was something that was of great interest to people because the brain was thought to be the seat of the human soul. But on the strength of his fame as a dissector and anatomist, Steno was invited to the court of, this is the Grand Duke Ferdinand de' Medici of Tuscany. Now, Ferdinand had been the patron of Galileo. After Galileo had his troubles with the church, Ferdinand was the one that took him under his wing and took care of him for the rest of his life. And Ferdinand financed an academy of scientists who were devoted to following Galileo's tradition in experimental science. So this was a wonderful environment for Steno to come into, because money was no object. He would give his scientists gold and rubies, whatever they wanted to do some experiments on rubies, not a problem. Here they are. Funding's always a problem for a scientist, and this was heaven for Steno. Shortly after he arrived in Florence, some fishermen off the coast of Tuscany caught a gigantic shark. They pulled it ashore, they chopped off its head, and they sent it up to Florence, assuming that the Duke would be interested in seeing this thing, which he was. And this was a great occasion to get his new anatomist, Steno, to show his stuff, to dissect it, do a public dissection, which Steno did. And in the course of dissecting this shark, Steno took a close look at the teeth of the shark and noticed that they were very similar to tongue stones that he had studied as a medical student. So this question of how these, if they really were shark's teeth, how they would have gotten up in the mountains and the hills, of course, was very similar to the question of how seashells get up in the mountains. And so Steno, just in keeping with his comment about free my mind from the plague of distractions, he immediately kind of lurched from one avenue of research on his muscles and devoted himself full time to hiking around the hills in Florence and in Tuscany, looking at fossil seashells and things and trying to figure out what they were doing up there. And he came to the conclusion that they were really seashells, that they weren't growing in the rocks. He studied them and saw that that compared with things that you know grow in the earth, like roots that follow planes of weakness and long cracks and things, the shells always had a perfect shape. They're never distorted by growth within the hard substrate. And as an anatomist, it really kind of offended his scientific thinking that you would have these structures, like a shark's tooth, without a shark's mouth to go with it. He was one of the new wave of anatomists that saw the human body as a machine, and that the shape of the organs was a reflection of their function. Well, something that is made, that's obviously designed to slice flesh, it has to have a mouth to go with it. Also, Steno was an extremely religious man, and it also offended his religious sense that God would create something like this without any kind of purpose to it. So he convinced himself that fossils really were genuine fossils, and he set himself to try to answer that same question that had plagued the people that had been thinking about the shells as being evidence of the flood, and that is, how do these things get inside of solid rocks? And the result of Steno's studies was his most famous book, called De Solido. The full title is De Solido Intra Solidum Naturaliter Contento, meaning on solids occurring inside other solids, how you get an object inside another object. And the short answer is, the way you get a shell inside of rock is that it got inside before the rock turned to rock, that it was soft, that it was just sediment, that the shells were there on the bottom of the sea, and particles settled down and buried them, and then those particles turned into rock. This is the idea, if you've taken Geo-10, of a sedimentary rock. And from this idea that the rocks were settled out of water, he developed what are known as Steno's principles, which are the principles of stratigraphy. The first one is that layers accumulate from the bottom up, as you might expect of stuff settling down. The snow falls on the ground and other stuff falls on top of it. That the layers accumulate horizontally. So if you see in the mountains layers that are tilted, that means that something happened to tilt them. And also that the layers are continuous, that they don't just sort of stop and start and stop and start. So if you're on a hill and you've got a layer of limestone here, and there's a valley, and then on the other side there's another layer of limestone just staring right at you, then those layers were continuous, and that material in between had been worn away. So you've got the formation of rocks, you've got deformation of the crust, tilting and folding and stuff, and then you've got erosion. That's sounding a lot like geology to me, and a lot of other people, I think, would agree. This diagram here is his diagram of the history of Tuscany, according to his ideas. And it actually goes from the bottom right up, and then from the bottom of the left up again. So there were layers laid down, and then he didn't have much of an idea of the erosive power of rivers and streams, so he thought that valleys were formed by the collapse of caves. But anyway, the cave forms, and then that collapses, and then there's another cycle of layers building up, and that collapses, and then you've got the present-day landscape with several different sets of strata, some tilted, some level. And this was the very first attempt by anybody to actually try to piece together the history of any region by looking at the structure of its bedrock. So this is the very, very first geologic cross-section. Well, this publication, De Solido, was just about 26 pages long. It was very short. He had he was a very fastidious person, and he intended to write an extremely long, complete treatise on everything he had found out about rocks and fossils. However, he had gotten a letter from the King of Denmark calling him back to Denmark to become the royal anatomist. Now, Steno at that time didn't have a job. He was working in the court of the Medici, but he was basically a postdoc, and that doesn't have much job security. So this was a great thing. It was a wonderful opportunity for him, except for one problem. And that was, when he got the letter, he had just gotten back from church, where he had converted to Catholicism. And Catholicism was illegal in Denmark. You could be a Catholic, but you couldn't celebrate Mass, and the king wasn't really going to hire a Catholic to be his royal anatomist. So Steno wanted to go to Denmark and try to negotiate this, but first he felt he had to deliver on all this money that Ferdinand had spent on his geological studies. So he just dashed off this quick abstract of his work that was going to come later. I think it's actually a good thing, because I think if he had written the book he'd wanted to have written, it would have been really long and maybe nobody would have read it. It was this short book, and it was published and diffused around and made its way to England, where it was translated into English. And it wasn't ignored, but despite his sound reasoning and logic, people didn't quite buy it. And part of the problem was that his kind of science, what he was suggesting here, which is kind of more like a detective or forensic science looking at clues what happened in the past, wasn't the kind of science that was on the upswing then. The Royal Society was really promoting experimental science, and this wasn't something, he was talking about stuff that happened in the past, not something you could do in the laboratory. And so it seemed kind of vaguely unscientific to people. And this is a publication in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society a few years later. And this is a diagram of a woman's kidney. And a doctor reported that during an autopsy of this woman who had died of kidney stones, he pulled out of her kidney, see the left there, this perfectly formed seashells. That as I had said earlier, the shells, stones growing in the earth, stones growing in the body, the same process, and said, well, you're not telling me this woman's kidney used to be the ocean. So clearly, shells do grow inside of other bodies, and they don't necessarily have to be part of a living organism. Now, Robert Hooke, who was a member of the Royal Society, and he's an illustrious scientist in his own right. He's the guy who named cells you know, the cells in your body. And he had developed ideas similar to Steno's on his own. He pointed out now if the woman's kidney hadn't been in the ocean, the surgeon's sponge that he had mopped up the blood with had been in the ocean. So maybe one of the shells had fallen out from there into the body cavity. But he didn't persuade too many people with that. And this is an example of it just takes time sometimes for just ideas to sort of settle in and take over. It didn't. It was a long process, slow process, that Steno's ideas were finally became dominant in the scientific mainstream. And this was actually happened more in the following century, when with the developing industrial revolution, there are more and more people going out into the countryside, looking at rock strata, mapping them for coal or clay for making ceramics or other things. It took a long time for people to realize, well, this makes perfect sense, what he's saying about the strata. And there were a number of holdouts, even people like Voltaire and Thomas Jefferson, who were very skeptical of this idea of fossils being real, even 100 years later. But finally, they did take over, and so we've got geology. Now, Steno, he went his own path. He didn't he got the job actually in Denmark, but he didn't last very long because he couldn't practice his religion freely, and he was constantly being criticized by Lutherans for having broken the faith. So he went back to Italy, became a priest, and stopped doing science. And spent the last years of his life in Germany as a priest and a missionary, essentially, trying to reconvert the heretics, the Protestant heretics, back to Catholicism. And he died in 1686. He had destroyed his health, practically destroyed his health, by fasting and just living his life very simply. And for this life of heroic virtue, he was beatified by the Pope in 1988. Definitely the only geologist who's that far along, anyway, to being a saint. So Steno actually has been kind of an enigma to people. Why would this guy who really opened up the door to a whole new interpretation of the world, why would he give up science? And if you read accounts of it in scientific books, you know, he can be presented as someone who turned his back on science, or someone who caved into religious pressure. If you read the Catholic literature, it's different. They'll say that he's someone who followed a higher calling. Well, one thing that I was able to determine in writing, or I wasn't able to find any kind of evidence that there was any pressure on him to stop doing science, because there were a lot of priests that were doing science. There was also no evidence that there was any pressure on him to stop doing geology. In fact, when he returned to Florence after working in Denmark for a few years, Ferdinando, the Grand Duke, had died and his son was in his place, and Cosimo, this Grand Duke, was extremely conservative and banned all of the freedom that had previously been in there to talk about Galileo's work. He clamped down on that. Yet, he was pressuring Steno to complete more work on geology. And the quotes that exist were Steno's talking about his decisions to leave science and become a priest are more along the lines that he wanted to devote his life to other people, that he had led what he thought was a privileged life as a scientist, and that as a scientist he'd been able to travel and mingle more freely with other people of other faiths than politicians or other people could. And so he was going to sacrifice that for his faith. And one quote, and I can't give it to you verbatim, was that when you're a child and someone gives you a gift, you're fascinated by that gift. But then as you get older, someone gives you a gift, you pay more attention to the one who gave you the gift. And so his thinking was that he felt that God had created this wonderful world, and he wanted to be the one, he wanted to devote his service to the creator of this world. Now this instills my mind this harmony between the science and religion, and the lack of controversy that his scientific ideas generated in religious circles was a great surprise to me, because you read every week about the creationist and evolutionary controversies here in education, and the fights over whether the old Earth or young Earth. Well, part of the reason why it's so surprising to us is that we're thinking about it in the wrong way, because we're not thinking about it in the context of times. The issue at that time, really, with regard to the age of the Earth, wasn't really the length of time. It was a question of whether the world was eternal or whether it had a beginning. And in Steno's work, there was no problem. There seemed to be a sequence, and there was the implication of there being a beginning. But the concept of there being, that the world was eternal, that was problematic. And I'll read another little selection from my book that explains why. For a Christian, the world could not be eternal, because only God was eternal. To say that the world was eternal denied that it had a beginning, that it had been created by God, indeed, that it had been created at all. People were eternal, too, in the cyclical view of time. This raised all kinds of problems. If a person could borrow money in one cycle and repay it in the next, which some pagans saw as a perfectly acceptable practice, then where was the urgency for a sinner to reform and repay his debt to God? And the whole idea of salvation was thrown into question if the birth, crucifixion, and resurrection of Christ were not unique events in time, but happened again and again, ad infinitum. God forbid that we should believe this, wrote St. Augustine, for Christ died once for our sins, and rising again dies no more. So actually, in the thinking of that time, scientists and creationists are both creationists. Scientists would be creationists, because we believe that the world did have a beginning, that it isn't eternal. And that stretching the amount of time wasn't something that threatened any article of faith in the church. It just threatened, one reading of Scripture. So the battles were very different then. And oftentimes when you read histories of science, those sorts of things aren't taken into account. And we, I think, get a false impression of the history of science and religion, thinking that they were always for at loggerheads fighting tooth and claw. Most of the scientific controversies that I read about in researching this book had scientific and theological arguments on both sides. And oftentimes now, if you read it, you hear the scientific arguments of the winners and the theological arguments of the losers, which gives a false impression. There were, in fact, even scientific arguments against an old Earth. And that was, well, if the Earth is millions of years old, if the Earth is eternal, then why are there mountains? We can see things eroding. Why haven't they all been eroded away? And that was because at that time they didn't have any sense of the heat and the energy within the Earth that pushes up mountains and moves around plates. They didn't know that. And you can't blame them for not knowing that. So to me, Steno is a very he's a unique figure as a icon in science and religion. And also I think he's kind of a symbol of a lot of the overlap between scientific thinking and I'll say spiritual thinking. His most famous quote that he gave during his last lecture as a practicing scientist is, "Beautiful is what we see, more beautiful is what we understand, and most beautiful is what we do not comprehend." And to me, that last phrase is an indication of the desire to embrace the unknown and contemplate what you don't yet understand. Thank you. I guess there's time for questions. Oh, yes.
I was just wondering, was there ever an explanation for those shells in the cave?
Not really. I, besides Hooke's, a suggestion that maybe they were dropped there by the sponge of the surgeon. The other possibility is that the drawing there was embellished a little bit. That it was just they were just kind of weird looking kidney stones that reminded them of some of the in the earlier slide I showed the alphabet and other things that people found in rocks. In addition to that, there'd be images of the Virgin Mary and things like that. And oftentimes those things were embellished. And science was I think a little bit looser back then. So you know. Other questions? Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about the significance of of understanding the origins of the Earth religiously and scientifically?
That's a big question. The question is talk about the significance of understanding the origins of the Earth religiously and scientifically. For Steno. Oh. That's okay. I think he was doing his scientific work on geology right about the same time that he was going through his religious crisis. Deciding whether or not to abandon Lutheranism and convert to Catholicism. And one of the major issues between the two faiths was the authority of Scripture and, you know, what version. So my speculation is that at the same time he was looking at the rocks, he was also going back and reading the original Hebrew scriptures and all the stuff he could find in the original. I think he was hoping to find some way that experimentally verifying whatever scripture, trying to find another source of information about the Earth to get some sense of what versions were right, whatever. I think that. His interest in the origins of the Earth and his interest in the origins of the Christian faith were in parallel with one another. But that's just speculation. Yes?
There's apparently a new book out about Leonardo. I haven't read it. I just read the review that you wrote on it. It's just this throwaway line in the review.
obvious to anyone who reads Leonardo's notebooks that he had ADD. And your comments about Steno's journal and how he was fighting the tendency of his thoughts to race off in so many directions and all of his different images make me wonder if that could have been a problem and if it might have explained the attraction of his entering the priesthood where he would almost have a focus in his book.
Well, the first part of what you're saying, I mean, I had the same thoughts about him and ADD. And sometimes when I've talked, I've used that as a throwaway line about ADD. And it's not just in this journal. Later on, in fact, in his the preface of his book, of the solo, he talks about how he's jumped from one thing to another, from muscles to the heart to the brain, da-da-da-da. And he sort of resigned himself to it. He said, well, you know, if I'd stuck with all these other things, I wouldn't have ever found out about these other things. So, you know, as a paleontologist, my diagnosis is that he probably had ADD, but that's not worth very much. But I hadn't thought about your suggestion that entering in the priesthood gave him the focus he needed, because that's what happened. He just decided just to focus in on simplify my life. I'm just going to help people, help the poor. And so that's an interesting thought. Other questions? Oh, yes, Mary.
Ella, did he write anymore after he entered the priesthood?
He wrote quite a bit more on theology. Nothing on science. His notes for his book were lost. He had a student that he entrusted them to who was supposed to get them published, but then that student, who was a Dane visiting Steno in Florence, got called home by his parents because they were worried that Steno was going to convert him to Catholicism. So the student left, and the footlocker that was supposed to accompany him, it's not clear if that made it to Denmark, and if it did, it burned up in a fire that destroyed the library a few years later. His writings as a priest were all theological, except there are some notes he was making in the last year of his life about neurology, about nerves. And there are some references to discussions he was having about science in other people's letters. Gottfried Leibniz, the philosopher and mathematician, was friends with Steno when Steno was a priest, and Leibniz was really pushing Steno to finish his book on geology, which Steno never did. But then Leibniz wrote his book, Protogaea, which was one of the main vehicles that Steno's ideas in the next century got spread. So Steno, it's clear that Steno didn't reject his science. And in fact, there's one letter refers to Steno being irritated that people hadn't, wised up and accepted his ideas about fossils, even when he was a priest. So clearly he still held those same ideas. Oh, yes.
Sorry. So I guess Steno is clearly like an interdisciplinary kind of figure. You yourself are kind of also. What do you think of today's kind of science? Is that have as much of a place, or have you guys been so specialized? Is there an answer for Steno today, I guess?
I think it's hard. I mean, there's a lot of the question, if everybody didn't hear it, is that Steno, being a very interdisciplinary person, are there niches for people like that today in the scientific community? And there are. I mean, there are people who are successful at it. But I think it's an example might be Jared Diamond, who is a physiologist, but he writes about ecology, and he's had some best-selling books about anthropology, and he seems to be doing fine. But I think in science, it's very hard to be an interdisciplinary person. I just, by word of mouth, I hear that people that have too broad an interest can sometimes have trouble getting tenure at universities. Even if they're publishing and doing great work in a bunch of different things, if they're doing too many things and they're not the world's authority in one single thing, then that works against them. So I think it's hard.
You yourself have identified yourself as a paleontologist.
Yes.
But it seems like you're doing quite a bit of history, and I wonder how you met these challenges of being interdisciplinary yourself.
Well, you might say professionally what I've done is writing a book. The publisher pays me, they didn't have to worry about, some academic department. But the actual process of doing it was really difficult, because I didn't take any religion classes here. I took geology and I took two history classes. I liked them, but one of them was spring term my senior year, so I don't remember much about it. And so I had to, in researching this, I didn't really know what I was getting into. I started to write a book about geology, and then there was this same thing, and then reading about 17th century theology and history. And I solved the problem by just working like a crazy person, reading as much as I could find. And I'm glad I did, because too often people who write popular books just sort of skim the surface of the literature and just repeat the same old things. And I made a huge effort to get into the scholarly literature about the theology and the history and find out some of the complexities, rather than just say, well, he's a priest, whatever. So I don't know that there's a substitute to just diving in there and doing the work. But one thing I will say, though, is that when you do that, then the specialists in those fields really appreciate that. And I didn't encounter any, in my talking with historians, and when I talked with Danish scholars, I didn't encounter any kind of academic territoriality, like, who's this scientist writing about our stuff? Who's this American writing about, our guy? Everybody was just extremely helpful. The historians of science that I dealt with, and when I was in Denmark, the Danish scholars. So if you indicate that, you're really willing to do a thorough, responsible job, then people will really bend over backwards to help you out. You're just some geologist want to find out about theology, and they'll tell you. I guess there are no more questions.